Maybe I'm in love with you. I say maybe. Maybe I'm in love with you.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Carol Jacobson here in the studio with me. Carol, welcome to Living Writers.
Thank you, T.
Well, it's good to see you on this winter day. Everyone, you're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. We've got Steph behind the glass. Today, we're talking about Carol Jacobson's new book, For Dear Life, Women's Decriminalization and Human Rights in Focus. For Dear Life is just out this month with the University of Michigan Press. And I have like the ARC copy, and I noticed that your copy is even shinier than my, like, it's beautiful. The edition has just arrived.
Yes.
Via boat, were you thinking, maybe?
Yes, from the printer, yes.
Well, just in time for its February 2019 launch. And Carol, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, let's start by, the traditional way. I'll read the bio on the back of the book, and we'll go from there.
Okay.
Because there's a lot to say about your life, and we were just saying 30 years of work in this project.
Yes.
That Dear Life is representative of.
Yes.
Carol Jacobson is professor of art, women's studies, and human rights at the University of Michigan and director of the Michigan Women's Justice and Clemency Project. Now I'm going to add a little bit to that. By Marianne Wilkinson in her essay, Three on a Life Sentence. Marianne Wilkinson writes, as accomplished as she is as an artist, Jacobson is also an activist and critical writer who is not satisfied to simply point to an issue, but instead compels her audience toward an active, educated response. Her pioneering work, disturbing, compelling, and personalized, moves out into the world through multiple venues and sponsors, and her complex roles as artist, activist, educator, and writer redefine what an artist is. So, Carol, thanks for making time to come and talk and
my
to
pleasure.
Talk about this important work that you're doing. So 30 years ago, I guess, or, well,
it 1989, yes, was the first time I went into a women's prison. And it was at the invitation of an activist to make a short film with the women about their children's visitation program. And once I made that film for the women to raise funds for their program, I was inside long enough filming for over a month in and out, and I was shocked to discover that most women are serving time for gender-based crimes induced by poverty and or violence. Most of the women are poor, single heads of households. And I was especially shocked to discover who the so-called murderers are in our U.S. women's prisons. It was really jolting because so many are in for acting in self-defense against or because of violent men in their lives. And they were defending themselves in some way and nevertheless got convicted and are serving long sentences. So that really shook me.
And as part of, within For Dear Life, many women's stories are told and represented here.
Yes.
I think, is it Stacey Barker?
Yes.
Who is one woman who at her trial her defense attorney wasn't even allowed to include that fact that she was acting in self-defense. Even during the trial, the judge wouldn't allow it.
The judge refused to tell the jury that they had that the law, the self-defense law includes that a woman has a right to use self-defense and kill her attacker if she's being raped, and so the attorney actually wanted the whole self-defense law read to the jury, and the judge refused. So that was key in her case. And she, the first trial, she was allowed to testify, and it was a hung jury. And the second trial, she was not allowed to. Her defense attorney said, "You don't need to. We got this made," and she didn't testify. And she was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. She was convicted of first degree murder. And then it took another 17 or 18 years to get her third trial. And she then was allowed to plead to second degree by the prosecutor. And so she ended up serving 23 years, for killing a man that was trying to rape her. But he was a white Lutheran minister, and she was a 20-year-old black aide in the retirement center where he lived. And so she had no power, really, in the courts, as many women don't. And these each of the cases that are discussed in my book, and you also read their own words, because I filmed a lot of these women. And so there are excerpts, pages of excerpts from the films that are narrated by the women themselves. So you hear their words and their critiques of the system that fail us all. I mean, the criminal legal penal system is a total failure for everyone. All of our whole country, really. The prison industry is just such a disaster. But it's really a failure for women, because women have been the largest growing population, albeit that they're a small percentage of the prison population. They're only about 6%. But nevertheless, they have grown. The population number has grown something like 700% in the last three decades. And so that's double the ratio of men's incarceration. And so it's been not only, a war on drugs that we hear about, but it's also been a war on women. And women are easy arrests.
So it's not just the courts that are failing them, it's the justice system, almost justice in quotes, like
right.
Police officers who are not protecting
That's
women,
right.
who are perhaps, these are arrests that can be, and as attorneys too, getting results.
Yes, they're not educated enough about women's issues. The large proportion of the prison and incarcerated population are men. So everything is constructed for men, and primarily for violent men, and not for women lawbreakers who are, acting usually through acts of survival. Unlike male lawbreakers who are generally acting out of a desire for control or power over someone or something. So there's a vast difference between the reasons men and women break the law. And that's not taken into consideration. There's no mitigation of women's sentences when they're defending themselves and or for the reasons that they have broken the law. And of course, I mean, we have heard a lot about the race issue in the prison population, and that's horrific because 50% of the women in prison are women of color. And of course, they're only, 12 or 13% of the women's population. So black women are. And so that's way out of line. And 3/4 are poor mothers that are heads of households. And 2/3 are in for poverty-induced nonviolent gender-based crimes, things like shoplifting, drugs, which is not necessarily a gender-based crime, but it is because the arrests of women are usually women who have boyfriends that are in the drug trade, and they are either not involved or very minor involvement, yet they get convicted along with the, drug pushers because they're there.
And some of the sentences are so severe. Is it Violet, whose story is in For Dear Life,
yes,
who was in a fight with her brother and broke his car window shield after he had broken her hand in a fight with her? And then
the police were called by him. And that was Jamie. Actually.
Oh, Jamie.
Jamie.
Okay. Sorry. And, apologies.
Yeah. And so she was arrested and she was convicted of assault, even though he had assaulted her. And she served 4 years. She was given a sentence of 1 to 4 years. And that was in the 90s, and she was held in prison the whole time of her sentence. She was sentenced to 1 to 4, but served all 4 because she was a lesbian and because some of the guards had it really were in for her. It was a very homophobic scene. It still is to some large extent inside the prison. And so they kept her in prison the whole time, and some of the guards who had it in for her put her in segregation. She was in segregation almost her whole, I mean, really a good chunk of her incarceration, and she was raped while chained down, 4-point restraints, and she really suffered horribly. She got out of prison and really had the guts to file a lawsuit for torture against the state of Michigan, and she won her case. So she was really brave, and not only that, but then she gave me the footage of her being chained down over and over and over. There was over 6 hours of that footage shot by guards, and she narrated a short film.
Called Segregation Unit?
Yes. And so there's a chapter on that film and her narration in the book and talking about conditions of segregation and what that is like. And the tragic thing is it's only worsened since Jamie was in prison. And I have known many women now who have served long sentences in lockdown, in solitary confinement at Huron Valley Women's Prison, and the conditions are horrific. Women have been hog-tied. Women have been chained down. Women are over-medicated. They are sometimes not fed, sometimes not given water. They are medicated to the point of being zombies. There are women that I met some years back who were functional, who are not functional at all now because they've been so many years mostly in solitary. And the mental illness is unbelievable. I mean, the guards are not educated to care for people with mental illness, and some of the guards are just cruel, just outrageously cruel.
And it's male and female guards.
Yes,
Carol.
Yes. Uh-huh.
We're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back. Today on the program, Carol Jacobson is here. Her book, now out with the University of Michigan Press, For Dear Life, Women's Decriminalization and Human Rights in Focus. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. Today on Living Writers, Carol Jacobson is here in the studio. Her book, For Dear Life, Women's Decriminalization and Human Rights in Focus, just out now with the University of Michigan Press. Many thanks to Sam Killian for sending a copy of the book to Steph and I. So before the break, Carol, we were talking about Jamie's story, which is part of is a chapter of For Dear Life, and also a film, one of the films you made, Segregation Unit. Mm-hmm. And you were saying, I mean, it's hard to believe when someone views Segregation Unit or reads this section of For Dear Life that it could worsen.
Yes. Right.
After reading and seeing how you portray Jamie's experience and represent it here. But it is. And so you're an artist and you are an activist and
yes.
You are the director of the Michigan Women's Justice and Clemency Project.
Right.
And in this role, you've recently just posted a letter to Governor Whitmer. Is this right?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Can you could tell us about the letter?
Well, I wrote it to talk about that I was extremely concerned for the health and safety of prisoners at Huron Valley Women's Prison who are suffering miserably from dripping and oozing black mold and asbestos exposure, filth and unsanitary conditions that are because there are no proper cleaning equipment for the women to clean up, the extreme overcrowding and the abuses of women in solitary confinement. I mean, all of these things combined to create a real death trap at Huron Valley. And in fact, there have been 10 deaths in the last year at Huron Valley Women's Prison, which is really outrageous. Usually, there are one or two or so deaths a year at the women's prison, but I think the conditions...
Due to neglect or to suicide or to violence or end of life or health?
All of those, yes. Health conditions, age, suicide. There was a rash of suicide in 2010, I believe it was. And there are far too many suicide attempts there because of conditions and mistreatment, and mental illness, and there's no proper treatment. But 10 women's deaths in one year is something is definitely wrong, and something needs to be addressed. There needs to be a proper investigation, and not by the Michigan Department of Corrections itself.
Because the only way you got the footage from Jamie's segregation unit incarceration was through the Freedom of Information Act.
Well, because she filed a lawsuit and her attorney subpoenaed that footage. Yes, because it was an active lawsuit when she sued the state for torture and won. Only in that way can anyone get copies of that kind of footage. And there is video footage because there are cameras around the prison. And even in solitary, there are cameras. But it's really difficult to get that footage.
Why do they have the footage? Like, why are they taking
ostensibly
it?
To protect the state, to show that they're chaining properly, to show that they're drugging properly. But then nobody gets copies of it. Nobody sees it unless there is an active lawsuit and a subpoena. And if they haven't already erased it before you get a hold of it.
Oh, so yeah. There aren't logs. So, they aren't required to keep.
I don't know exactly what that law is or rule is, but it's very difficult to get a hold of that footage.
What do you hope with this letter to Governor Whitmer?
I hope there is an investigation. I really also hope she begins to address really strongly the prison population in Michigan. We need to go after it. We need to cut it back. We need to change the sentencing laws and address the prosecutors who are overcharging and who have the power to do what they want without real oversight. Prosecutors in this country have too much power. There have been studies showing that prosecutors, you know, do pretty much what they want, and they're really concerned with the notches on their belts and the convictions that they give, boost to their own careers more than they are about justice. I don't call it a criminal justice system. I call it a criminal legal penal system, because there is no justice in our system today.
And that's what your book, it feels like it's working towards, a call for a new justice, a movement that's about rehabilitation, like about reorienting the landscape.
I am really heartened and glad to see, you know, so many movements today. The Innocence Movement, The battered women's clemency movement, which started back in 91 when Governor Celeste in Ohio released 25 women or 26 women. And Angela Davis has led quite a crusade, and there are many different groups that have really begun to get traction. And some of the wonderful books that have come out, you know, Michelle Alexander's book and Just Mercy by Stevenson, and a number of wonderful
and Heather Ann Thompson.
And Heather Ann Thompson.
Blood in the Water.
Here at University of Michigan. She's terrific, and her book is fabulous, about the Attica prison uprising. Yes. And so there has been some important scholarship and some amazing activist movements out there that have really begun to get traction on the prison system and industry and mass incarceration in this country.
Governor Granholm, when she was in office, did you hope for more? Because my sense from reading For Dear Life, I couldn't understand why she didn't take a stronger stand for women.
Right.
And justice.
We had high hopes for her as a Democrat and as a woman. And I have to say she did more than most. She was urged on by Governor Milliken, and he worked with us for years on the Michigan Women's Justice and Clemency Project and was a great, great supporter. And so he urged her to do some clemencies, and she did. She did 10 clemencies of women who had first-degree murder. One was conspiracy to murder, but it was first-degree. So those 10 women got out. Four of them were represented by the Michigan Women's Justice and Clemency Project. And then she released four more women on who had second-degree murder convictions, or she forced the parole board to release them by setting up a special commutation board. And that was key. And
how so?
Well, that because the parole board is comprised of people who are former guards, former sheriffs, police officers, primarily.
All part of the system that's
yes,
put them
and they
there.
Have a vested interest in keeping people in prison.
Saving face.
That's right. And they don't want to let people out of prison, and they don't. They are really hard on, and of course, they too are not educated about women and women's lawbreaking, so they treat them like violent men, and they mistreat them. I have attended now many, many public hearings for women who have murder convictions, and of course parole hearings too, and the treatment is just awful by some of those members of the parole board. Sometimes women have been called names. I mean, it's unacceptable, the behavior of the parole board members.
So that's why there's a need for this commutation?
Yes. But this governor who led us on, I have to say, Snyder, the last governor, led us to believe that he was really going to grant some commutations for women in the Clemency Project. They reviewed, more than a dozen women's cases, said they were all compelling. They were going to do something. They were for these women, and we had meetings with them. I did with our volunteer attorneys, Lynn Dorio and Rebecca Weidlinger, and we were so hopeful. But he released only one woman, granted clemency to only one woman we represented and left the rest hanging, or I should say still in prison. And it was a huge disappointment. I don't know why they did that, but it was, it was really painful. And
well, it stops your forward momentum with the work if you think something's coming.
Yes.
So you're waiting.
Yes.
Which is much like being in prison if you're told 1 to 4 years and then you're not told when you might be able to get out, and it becomes the 4 years.
And of course, with the parole board, life means life, and they are, as far as they're concerned, you die in prison. Even if you have so-called parolable life, which was supposed to be parolable after 10 or 15 or 20 years, it varied depending on when you got convicted. And yet those people who are in with parolable life don't get out either.
Let's hope for more from Governor Whitmore.
Yes.
More from Whitmore.
Yes.
Okay, we'll take a short break and then we'll be back. Today,
okay.
Carol Jacobson is here. Her book, For Dear Life, Women's Decriminalization and Human Rights in Focus. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Carol Jacobson is here. Her book, out with the University of Michigan Press, For Dear Life, Women's Decriminalization and Human Rights in Focus. And Carol, thanks for picking the songs for today's program, too. I think we just heard Laurie Anderson's, her big win at the Grammys. Beautiful and haunting.
Yes, it is. Yes, I'm thrilled that she won.
Yes. Shout out to Laurie Anderson.
Yeah.
So Carol, before the break, let's go to this moment in your history. Well, you're an artist. and we haven't even begun to talk about that yet today. I picture you graduating from school, going over to England, an artist. Were you in search of a project? And what did, you found something quite compelling.
Yes, when I graduated from grad school in art, I really was actually mad as hell. I felt that I had not had the opportunity to develop as a feminist as I wanted to in my work, and had been ridiculed for doing anything political or anything feminist, and therefore had
by the professors.
Yes. So I backed off. So I went to London. I was living in London for a year, and I heard about Greenham Women's Peace Camp, and I wondered about it. And a friend of mine and I decided to go there. It was a peace camp protesting nuclear weapons outside London, and we went there and we tromped around the military base where the nuclear weapons were stored, and met these women that were camped out there for years. They were camped out, and I then followed some of the women to court who were being arrested for disturbing the peace and disorderly conduct and so on for their protests. When I came back to the U.S., I was wondering who is getting arrested here for disturbing the peace. What women are getting arrested? And I soon realized it was prostitutes. It was sex workers. So I went to court again in Detroit, 36th District Court, and I met women coming out of jail who had been working the streets, and I began to talk to them. And then the second year I went during the summers when I wasn't teaching, and I took a camera woman with me and set up across the street from the courthouse in the parking lot, and I paid women and asked them if they would give their opinions of the arrest process and the jail system and the police and the courts. And so they gave their own critiques of the system. And one day a judge asked me what I was doing in her courtroom, and I told her I was doing research, and she asked me to come back to her office, and she said, "Well, what are you doing research about these women for?" And I said, "Well, it's something that interests me. These women are being criminalized for working on the only jobs they know how. Their mothers are prostitutes. Their sisters are prostitutes. This is the way they're making their living." And she said, "Nobody cares about these women, you know, except they're pimps, and this is not art. So you just better cut it out." And I didn't, but the next time I was there, she came outside and told my camera woman that I better leave or she'd have me arrested. But she didn't, and I didn't stop going. And
you saw it. You felt like it's art. You felt like you were going to make something with these videos.
Yes, I did.
Or these voices.
Yes, right. Yes. And, you know, and because of that work, I was asked to go inside the women's prison to make a film inside and with the women. And
was this the work that you put in an exhibit that was at the University of Michigan Law School?
The prostitution work was, yes. Yes, that was censored by the law school. Yeah.
And that you had to fight in order to be able to have the exhibit.
Yes. Yes. And so we did battle over that. The ACLU represented me and other artists that were in the exhibit that I had put together on prostitutes' rights. And that was 92. And so we did battle for a year, and finally the law school was forced to reinstall the whole show. And that was, you know, an important victory for artists and for the First Amendment and for prostitutes' rights.
Well, and you have For Dear Life, for the book, you also have a concurrent gallery exhibit in the Chelsea district of Manhattan coming up in March. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
That is a show called Life on Trial, and it is a video installation, and it's a piece that I shot with Stacy Barker. Stacy is a woman who spent 23 years in prison,
and who we mentioned briefly earlier in the program,
right.
And who was part of one of your earlier films, Three on a Life Sentence.
Yes,
with Marion Dolores on the.
Yes, yes, and Stacy is out of prison now. She got herself out with an appeal. Mary also got herself out on an appeal, thank goodness, which is not an easy thing to do at all. But I have been working since I met Dolores, too, in 1990. And I was hoping she would get clemency from Governor Snyder. And we did get a public hearing for her, but the parole board turned her down and the governor turned her down because of the parole board. So she's still in prison, and I am heartbroken because I feel really especially invested in some of these women, you know, that I have known for so many years. Many have been released. Some have died. Some died in prison. And so it's hard sometimes. The work is really hard to deal with. But
as an artist, this is your work as an artist is around the justice, the injustice of the lives of these women.
Yeah, it is prison. Interdisciplinary. I mean, it's visual art, it's filmmaking, it's photography, but it's also it's also, you know, venturing into journalism and documentary and the legal system. So there's, most art is interdisciplinary. It's about something. And it's about ideas and issues and social concerns and political questions and human rights questions. And my work just happens to cross those journalistic and legal law boundaries as well as art.
Art sounds like the exhibits. The exhibits are very important to you as an artist in a way that you're creating an experience for people to come into.
Yes. Yes. And they're always in New York, co-sponsored by Amnesty International, and who has also shown my work in other venues abroad, and so has Human Rights Watch. So it is educational. It is experiential. I want people to feel as I feel, to really understand women's incarceration as a question of injustice, a question of sexism, misogyny, and to begin to address the whole prison industry and system of criminal legal so-called justice in our country.
Let's take a short break and then we'll be back. Today on the program, Carol Jacobson is here. Her book, For Dear Life, Women's Decriminalization and Human Rights in Focus, out with the University of Michigan Press. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
I'm in a hurry. I can tell you how it feels to be holding on to the one I suppose.
supposed to be.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. Today on the program, Carol Jacobson is here for Dear Life, Women's Decriminalization and Human Rights in Focus, out with the University of Michigan Press. Carol, thanks so much for coming by today to talk.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, T.
Well, it's meant a lot to me. And your work, I'm honored that you're here, and I'm in awe of what it takes to be the maker and the person out in the world that you are. So thank you for doing what you do. Now let's talk about the book.
Okay.
Shall we?
Yes.
Because we've got it here on the table. It's a beautiful book. It's a difficult book. How did you create the experience? Because it's crossing through your work for 4 decades, 30 years now.
Yeah.
Are represented within the covers of this book for Dear Life.
Yes. Well, it is sort of more or less chronological, and it does follow my projects chapter by chapter from the first time I went inside the prison and began, and also the prostitutes' rights work. And as it develops, I included letters from the women as well as excerpts from the films, so you read that they narrated, that the incarcerated women narrated, so you read their words and their experiences and their critiques of the system and the, you know, courts and the penal prison system in their letters and their words from the films. There are essays by 15 scholars who write about these issues of women and justice.
And often connected to your films.
My films, yes. And there are documents, for example, our first clemency granted by a governor that we ever got, granted by Governor Granholm in 2008, is reproduced. Also an amicus brief that I helped to write for one woman who got to the U.S. Supreme Court with her appeals, lost there, but didn't actually get a hearing by the U.S. Supreme Court, but made it all the way there. So there are a lot of documents, a lot of letters, a lot of headlines and articles about the coverage of the Clemency Project that I run. And
those are often collaged as well.
Yes.
Or as like a background with some of the women's quotes superimposed or images.
Yeah. So the press coverage that we've received for the rallies at the state capitol that I organized over the years for women, you know, against women's incarceration. And so there's a lot of visual. I mean, it's really very much a visual book. And it documents together with the women and together with a number of feminist scholars in law and art who write their essays. So it was a wonderful experience putting it together. And of course, it's very visual. It has a lot of my photography and film stills and imagery.
And images of the gallery exhibits, so that you would be able to have a slight idea of what it might be like to walk into the space.
Right.
And again, it's the women's voices are represented throughout. Their voices in text, their faces in photographs. Quickly, to go back to Three on a Life Sentence, when you made that film, you describe a moment of showing it in the prison, which was quite uncanny to read about this. I was nervous just starting to read it because you describe who's in the room. So Stacey, Mary, and Dolores are there. You are there. And behind you are some guards and other prison officials.
Actually, this was from one prison, that film.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay. And it was four women. It was Violet Allen, Linda Hamilton, and Juanita Thomas, and who else? For anyway, we sat together in the room, and there were guards and the warden on one side of me, and the four women in the film on the other side of me. And we watched as we watched it, the mood in the room changed as the women went in the film from discussing their crimes, you know, killing their abusers in self-defense, to their critique of the prison system. And suddenly the guards were all moving around and, you know, making noises and shuffling their feet and very upset. They didn't like hearing that part. And I was nervous that, you know, for the women's safety. And repercussions, because they deal a lot with retaliation from the guards. But at the end, the women all hugged me, which is a luxury in prison, since just touching is a sexual misconduct, and can be very costly to the women. But the warden allowed us to hug. And
they seemed unafraid.
They were unafraid. They felt really validated by each other. And the things that they had said were, they didn't realize when they were filmed that they were saying things that echoed each other. And the way I put that together was reinforced their stories for the first time, they said, and that meant a lot to them and to me. It was really a moving experience. And I've only been able to show two films inside. The others have you know, critiques of the system as well as the voices of the women and the injustices of their cases. So it's difficult to show those. And I'm worried about getting this book inside Huron Valley Women's Prison to the women who participated in it, because they deserve to see this book and to enjoy it and read it and feel validated by it.
And know that it's out in the
and
world.
And know that it's out here, yes. So I'm hoping that they can be allowed to have a copy. We'll see.
I hope so, too. Is there a piece of a woman's letter that you'd want to read? Because we have a very short time, but just perhaps as...
I think you mentioned one to me that I think I'll read from Kinnery. It's dated January 11, 2008. Dear Carol, namaste. I'm sorrow-laden to share the news of my commutation denial. Of course, I was there at her commutation hearing and her public hearing. And she says, the reason given is compelling opposition. and that I remain unable to accept full culpability for my criminal behavior. I don't know what more can I do or say to them to see one more, to see me more than a crime. I'm gathering my broken pieces so I can overcome this sorrowful, this sorrow that pulsates inside. Thank you so much for the support you've provided me throughout the years. Sincerely, Kinnery. So that's just one of the letters in the book, among many. Kinnery was lucky in some ways because she didn't get a life sentence. So she served her sentence and was released and deported back to India. She had been in an arranged marriage to a man who was sexually abusive, and she killed him in self-defense.
Carol, thank you for coming and talking today. It's meant a lot to me. Please come back.
Thank you so much, T. I enjoyed it and appreciate having the chance to talk about my book. Thank you.
For Dear Life, Women's Decriminalization and Human Rights in Focus, Carol Jacobson, today on Living Writers. Thanks to Steph for engineering. Thanks to Frank Uli for post-production work. Follow us at Living Writers and on Instagram and Twitter. Next week is fundraiser, folks, so please join us then. Stephanie Douglas Carpenter is the Living Writers engineer. I'm T. Hetzel. Until then.